The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. If you're enjoying the show, head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make The Sewers of Paris possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello, I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. On tonight's episode, The Wizard of Oz, The Brady Bunch, and a never-completed sitcom starring Diana Ross. My guest this week is TV writer Stan Zimmerman, whose credits include episodes of The Golden Girls, Gilmore Girls, Brady Bunch Movie, and the Gay Kiss episode of Roseanne, among many, many more projects. As a kid, Stan created a fantasy television network in his bedroom, giving a weekly variety show to his idol Lily Tomlin, something that he was able to tell her about years later when they became colleagues. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, I want to let you know that I've got a new video going live on YouTube this weekend. It's about the most iconic gay couple of the 24th century, Star Trek Deep Space Nine's Garak and Bashir, and about how fans were ultimately responsible for bringing these star-crossed lovers together. Join me for a live stream leading into my new video this Sunday, July 11th at 11 a.m. Pacific at youtube.com/mattbaum. And a quick reminder that I've got a little newsletter where I share sneak peeks at what I'm working on. Sign up for that at mattbaum.com. Also, a big thanks to everyone who supports The Sewers of Paris on Patreon, and to everybody who's reviewed it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Now, here's my interview with Stan. Well, this week I'm speaking to Stan Zimmerman, an Instagram star and television writer. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
It is probably very cliche, but The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, fantastic. Tell me about The Wizard of Oz. When was the first time, or do you remember the first time you saw it?
As a little kid, I remember being scared of the witch, and actually my parents brought home a little Karen Terrier, which is a Toto dog. Mm-hmm. And we're so original. What do you think we named her? Toto.
Did you name her Toto?
Yes, we did. And I think they lied to us, but I want to believe that it's true. They said that she was actually related to the actual dog in the movie. So I'm going to go with that story. But I just loved it. And then I got to act in the play in a summer stock production in Hampton, New Hampshire. I was the Scarecrow, of course. Mm-hmm. And I keep coming back to that theme. Whenever I'm writing something, it's so funny how that storyline keeps popping up. It's a classic, and it's such a wonderful tale.
What aspect of it, like when you were a kid, like was there a particular aspect of the story or the theme that like was your favorite part or that really resonated?
I think, if you want me to lie down on the couch, we could really get into this. Probably as a closeted gay kid, going, not being understood and running away and then going to a land and meeting people that liked you. But then you had to go home in the end. So all of that. And I just love the witches. I just Margaret Hamilton, for some reason, just that she was it for me. But Ray Bolger, and I love that Judy Garland said at the end, or Dorothy, I'm going to miss you most of all. Mm-hmm. I thought that was just so beautiful. And just the way the colors, to go from black and white to color. And I kind of use that not to skip decades, but I directed a production, I guess it was 3 years ago, of The Diary of Anne Frank that caused a little bit of a controversy when I cast everyone in the attic with Latinx actors. Mm. Because I wanted to make the connection to what was happening about child separation in the United States at the time. And I saw a CNN report about a Jewish woman in LA who was hiding a Latina mom and her two daughters when her husband was suddenly deported by ICE. And I thought, we're literally living in the Anne Frank times. So because I had such Wizard of Oz damage, I directed the play in that I almost made the beginning of the play black and white on stage. And I've always loved that idea of how could I paint on stage without any color, just black and whites and grays. Mm-hmm. And I had noticed when the children were separated in real life, when we returned them, we had taken all their clothes and we gave them government issued dark gray hoodies. So I had the whole cast in black pants and gray hoodies. And as the play went on without the audience even knowing, they would undo the zipper a little bit each time. And they each had a different color of the rainbow underneath it. Get it, the rainbow? And then when they came back in Act Two, they were all in that color of their T-shirt in a period piece. So it literally went from black and white to color on stage. And they also were reading from the script, and the scripts magically disappeared. So that's how you can see the damage that movie did to me. But I've always just been fascinated with all the details of it. And as was my mother, yes.
Yeah, and you said that you got to be in the play as the Scarecrow. So it seems like it's kind of intersected with your life at some crucial
times. Many times. So I wonder where it's going to go next.
Yeah. Well, tell me about like this little kid who was fascinated by the Wizard of Oz. Like, was it something that like was that just your regular movie that you'd see whenever possible? Like, was this at a time when
back
it was, like,
then before you were born? It was only on TV once a year. So when that came on, it was a big deal, and we all just planned our evening around it.
Where were you growing up?
I grew up in a suburb of Detroit, Michigan. Mm-hmm. I like to say around 10 Mile because people know the Eminem movie 8 Mile.
Okay.
So I was 2 miles north of all that craziness. And I wasn't your normal kid because I wasn't outside playing football or baseball or basketball because I couldn't dribble. I couldn't shoot any of it with the basketball. So I did what any normal kid would do. I started my own TV network in my bedroom.
Oh, tell me about that. What was on the network?
Well, I actually made out of cardboard one of those scheduling boards. So I would schedule my network shows 7 days a week, mind you, against the major networks, whatever they were scheduling. And if there was a show that got canceled that I didn't think, should have been, I would pick it up on my network. And I made artwork, I made ads for the shows, and I was obsessed with Lily Tomlin. And I thought she deserved to have a weekly variety show. I just couldn't understand why nobody was giving it to her. I mean, she had occasional TV specials, but I needed to see her weekly. So I gave her a prime time slot. I think it was Friday at 10 o'clock, mm-hmm. an hour. And I actually got to tell her that years later. So one of my many full circle moments. I'm actually writing about in my book, mm-hmm. Which I'm not doing because I'm talking to you. So I like the distraction. But I'm writing a book called The Girls from Golden to Gilmore. And it's about all the wonderful women I've worked with and Roseanne. Mm-hmm. And how these wonderful women helped shape me and make me the man I am today. And Lily was one of them.
Did you have a name for the network?
Yes. I don't know where I got this from. But I saw something in the paper about a Hughes television network, and it was named after, I guess, Howard Hughes owned it, and he was a very rich man. And they actually now have like a Hughes broadband company. So I guess my network is still going on some level. So I don't know why I called it the Hughes, because I needed money to back it, right? Or imaginary money. Mm-hmm. So I had Howard Hughes back my network.
All right. Not bad.
Not bad if you're going to do it. I don't even know if he was still alive then, but I thought, well, he has a network, so he just needs like programming. So it was the Hughes Television Network, HTN.
So where did you go from there? Being this kid who's really fascinated with TV and entertainment.
Yes, I was obsessed with everything TV, and we had TV Guide. I memorized the TV Guide, and I wrote a TV column in my, what we called the junior high back then, I wrote a TV column, and each week was about, or each month maybe, was about a different kind of TV show, like a sitcom or drama shows or cop shows. And then I would have little news, which I would rip off from TV Guide about new shows that were coming on. And then my father would go once a year to New York, and I said, just bring me back the weekly variety. And I would memorize it in my room, like every Broadway show and what theater they were at. I was obsessed with movies and TV and theater, and always thought that I would come to California for college, to like USC or UCLA. And then I went to a summer theater school in Hampton, New Hampshire. And everybody there said, if you're serious about acting, you have to go to New York. You can't go to California. Mm-hmm. So I set my sights on New York and luckily got into NYU at 17 years old. And in their drama program, which was connected with Circle in the Square, we got to pick a different school. It was Circle or Stella Adler or Lee Strasberg. And you did 50% at the acting schools and 50% regular classes on campus.
And what was your plan? Like, was it just, I'm going to be an actor?
I was going to be an actor. I always had these great ideas, but I didn't read as a kid. So mm-hmm. I never thought I could be a writer, but I knew I had great ideas. And then I knew from watching this show called The Dick Van Dyke Show, which was about a writer's room, like three writers mm-hmm. in a room. And I thought, well, if I could meet someone that I could write with. And I had this idea like writing partners, but I didn't really know what that meant. And I found my writing partner at NYU, Jim Berg, and we started writing in between classes and after school jobs. And he was studying journalism, which it was great because he brought that technique to the work, which I didn't have. And I brought acting. So it was very important for all the characters to come out of real moments or have emotional arcs of their character. So over the years, and I'm still writing with him. In fact, I'll see him tomorrow. And we kind of were able to take on each other's personalities and learn from each other those specific crafts to bring to our work.
What was the focus for you then? Like as a young actor, like did you have a particular kind of show that you wanted to do or a particular kind of, I don't know, character that you like to inhabit?
I knew I was really funny. And so at theater school, we were given these really corny plays and I would somehow happen to change a few lines or costumes and they would get laughs. And the people that ran the camp were not happy, but the audiences were so happy they just had to go along with it. So that's when I knew when I first heard people laughing at me that, oh my God, this is something I have to do for a living, but how? And so then I found my writing partner and also I was terrible at auditions. I would just, my face would get all uncomfortable and kind of freeze and shake in weird ways. And I could feel it. And I'm like, oh my God, people noticing literally my face is shaking. And which is odd because now I teach acting audition classes because I've done it and I can speak from experience and how you can go in there and face your fears and learn to enjoy auditioning. But back then I was so young and I was in the closet and scared and I couldn't do it. But again, in full circle moments, I'm actually now in a play that I wrote, not to bring the room down, but it is about suicide. And I play me basically. I created a play called Right Before I Go using real suicide notes like Kurt Cobain and war veterans and LGBTQ kids and kids that were bullied. And kind of like vagina monologues. And it originated with just the letters and notes. And then my director, Michael Wilson, suggested I put my own story with my very close friend that died by suicide, which kind of led me to create this play to create awareness around the subject. And I didn't want to write myself into it. I just wanted to just not write and tell that part and open my heart to obviously a lot of pain with it, but I did. And then someone else was going to act in it. And at the last minute he dropped out and there was no showgirls. There was no like beads thrown down, you know, by me to get in it. I wasn't planning to be in it, but the director said, you have to do it. And I've been doing it all over the United States a couple of times actually with high school students, which is just an amazing experience. And actually, it's my first play that is officially published, which I haven't announced yet, but I will on 19th, actually.
Well, that's awesome. That's very exciting.
Because, thank you. So that's been a huge dream of mine, but also more important is that I have a company behind it that will get the word out about the play and hopefully can be produced all over the world, most likely not with me as the narrator, but I'm available if people want me to come to their town. And I would love that experience to go to different towns and connect with people and help save lives. And there's there's a lot of funny stuff in it too, but it ends with hope. So it's not, you know, just, you know, all tragic.
So tell me about getting into writing. And it sounds like you're really, you know, using that to do a lot of good now. What was the impetus?
Lately I've been wanting to marry art and advocacy together. So in a lot of my pieces, even the comedies, I've dealt with like my mother's dementia. I wrote a comedy about circumcision, believe it or not, called Knife to the Heart. So dealing with real topics, but in a funny way. And luckily, early on, just, you know, the subjects that we were able to deal with on Golden Girls, like one of the early episodes we wrote was about sexual harassment. And like, what, you know, unfortunately, we're still talking about that subject. And then on, you know, with Roseanne writing the lesbian kiss episode and what that brought up. So I guess in some way, I've just always been drawn to Subjects that needed exploring, but in a very commercial way. And I also think, especially with comedies, if people are laughing, they're much more open to taking in information.
Can you tell me about getting from New York, where you'd come to be an actor, and how did you find yourself writing for television? I assume you moved to LA to do that.
I slept my way to the top. No, I wanted to, but nobody would have me. My writing partner and I just kept writing and writing and writing and writing. And then I was sick of being poor in New York, and I said I had to get out of New York, and came out to California, and he came out a couple months later, and we kept writing spec scripts and going to free tapings because we couldn't afford even to go to movies at that point. And we just, one spec script was just the one, like probably the fifth one we wrote. And it just exploded, and we suddenly became the flavor of the month.
What was the script?
Well, actually, it was for a new show that we went to the taping for, and we just loved the writing of it. It was an ensemble show about a bunch of people in a bar called Cheers. Mm-hmm. And we walked out of there going, we have to write these characters. They were so smart. It was so different than most of the stuff that was on TV. And that was just the right combination of the story and the characters. And suddenly, you know, all these people that weren't calling us back were suddenly inviting us out to, you know, take us to lunches and dinners. And it was very exciting. It seemed like forever, but it was less than a year that I was out here scrounging around and getting really kind of depressed.
Which episode was it that was the script that hit?
Well, it was that you write it on spec, but you don't expect it. It's not for Cheers. You just write it on spec to show that you can write an existing show and existing characters. You very rarely get that show that you write it for to buy it, because there's no way of you knowing the characters as well as the people on staff. Although, oddly enough, that script, we wrote an episode for a show called Brothers on Showtime. It was one of the first gay sitcoms. Mm-hmm. And they had us take that storyline and rewrite it for Brothers.
Oh, okay.
It did get used, but that's rare. And we also, very rare that we wrote a Roseanne spec and we got on Roseanne, but that's pretty abnormal that would happen. But I guess that's just my life of abnormalities.
So you weren't like writing staff. You weren't in the room.
Yeah, you'd go home and you write what you think would be like a great Cheers script. And then that's also a tool for people to hire you on shows, because you're showing them that you can write characters that you did not create.
What did it feel like? Like, did it seem like your life had just completely changed all of a sudden when everybody wanted you and people were like, suddenly, oh, these are the writers. These are the hot new things.
Yes. It was odd, because you're like, I'm the same writer I was a couple of months ago. Why suddenly? You know, I didn't understand that. And I still don't understand to this day. You know, this town is about, you know, if you're hot and suddenly everybody wants you, and like, you're the same writer you are, whether you've had a hit or not. And I always believe you're either a good writer or you're not. And there are a few people in the business that respect that and see that. But most people, they kind of want, you know, whether you're agents or producers, they don't want to have to work that hard. And it's so hard to sell something that they don't want to have to push somebody that they know is not necessarily everyone's trying to grab for. But I mean, we had so many great years where we were offered like multiple shows per season, and what we wanted to do with, you know, which one we wanted to do, or do we want to develop our own. But I was always one to stop and really appreciate the moment. And I think luckily, you know, if you want to get spiritual about it, I found Shirley MacLaine's book was very popular at the time. And I was this, you know, like picture, like a young B. Arthur, picture it, B. Arthur, in a Jewish man's little body. And I just felt like you had to be sarcastic and kind of snarky to be funny. And then someone gave me Shirley MacLaine's book, and it just opened my mind to believe everyone has their own beliefs, and who am I to judge other people? And it really was an awakening for me that I could still be funny and still be loving at the same time. So that kind of changed my path. And also how to just find happiness in situations like we were on a TV show that I just did not want to be on, but we had made the commitment, and just be happy in the present.
Did you find yourself, was it possible to put anything, like, I know you had the Roseanne, the big gay kiss episode. How often did homosexuality or just like anything kind of approaching that affect the work that you were doing?
Well, this is also in the book, which I didn't think was going to be a part of it, but someone that was reading the first two halves of it said it's such an arc in your book of coming to Hollywood, being in the closet, being told you had to bring women to any events, even on something as open as Golden Girls. We were not allowed to talk about who we were. So that was all kept, which people find shocking, but it's true. And then Jim and I decided we were probably one of the first openly gay writing teams, and we were featured in the article about people being out in Hollywood. And our representatives did not want us to do it. But at that point, it was just, I have to be who I am. I wasn't hiding it amongst friends, but it was freeing to finally be out. And then that switched to suddenly, you know, Tom Arnold is running through the offices of Roseanne screaming, "Where are my gay writers?" Mm-hmm. So that was very different. But, you know, imagine going to work and you can't tell people what you did over the weekend. You can't say, "Oh, I went to West Hollywood. I went to Studio One and danced, or I met this nice boy." You didn't talk about that. We had to talk about other things.
When did that article happen, and how much, I don't know, how deliberative were you about, like, should I do this or not?
I mean, we were asked and we're like, yep. I didn't hesitate. You know, we told our reps and they wanted to talk us out of it, but we're like, no, we committed to this. And it was just who we were. And it was just great to be a part of that. And then, you know, then like with the Roseanne Kiss episode, we held a huge benefit for GLAAD the night that it was airing, and like CNN and all these news organizations came, and we had this, like, you know, it was like 500 people packed into this big dance place in West Hollywood. And we didn't know if it was going to come on the air or not, because the network up to the last minute kept saying we may cut the whole thing or just show the back of her head, and which they kind of did, but you can see the kiss. And when that happened, there was just a roar in the room. It was like the walls were going to tumble down. It was just very, very, very exciting, you know. And then, you know, luckily, soon after, you get an Ellen and a Will and Grace, and now we're at Schitt's Creek.
Yeah, yeah. It's just an incredible shift. And like you were right there at the start of, you know, not like the first gay character ever, but like at a period where things were like the momentum was a lot of change very quickly.
Very quickly, because the networks at the time were afraid of losing sponsors. So, you know, we'd be watching 30 something and no, you can't have two men in a bed together. And so to have something physical, it just wasn't heard of. And the ratings were so big that nobody could argue with that. But there still is so much homophobia in Hollywood. And, you know, we're still having a problem selling our Silver Foxes TV series, because it has the bonus of being gay, but also older characters. And people still find it okay to practice ageism in Hollywood. And I even see it just reading my Facebook pages, the way people talk about older people. You just would never talk about other people that way. And it's just kind of shocking to me.
I'm so curious about the Roseanne episode. Where did that come from? Like where did the genesis of the idea, like, did you propose that or did they come to you?
I think they always wanted to do something gay. What we learned very quickly on Golden Girls was to challenge who the characters are, and that made the best episodes. That's how we came up with the sexual harassment story for Blanche. She was always, her go-to was to have sex. So what situation could we put her in where she would say, you know what, not this time? And that's why it made it such an interesting episode. And so with Roseanne, at the time, she was very liberal. Who knows where she is now, but... and so we love the idea of what would kind of, you know, challenge her. She's so liberal, but then kissing another woman freaked her out and everybody around her. And so that's how we came up with that, not knowing that the network would say we couldn't do it. And then to Tom Arnold and Roseanne's credit, they said, we're filming it whether you like it or not. And if you don't show it, we'll buy time on HBO and air it there. So that's why you know, it's hard to reconcile Roseanne, who she is today, because she was such a fighter for the underdog back then. So, you know, when she follows somebody like Trump, you kind of go like, well, wait, what happened?
Hmm. When that, you mentioned the premiere party, when everybody watching it, was it really like everyone with bated breath? Like, what are we actually going to see on screen?
Which is so crazy because when I think about it, I was like, well, it aired on the East Coast. So why did nobody call us and say they did it? You know, I don't know. It was just, there was this anticipation because it was on the news. Literally, the 11 o'clock news was covering the story that I was living during the day. So I'd come home at night and see them talk about, you know, are they not going to do it? What's ABC going to do? And ABC didn't want to be seen as being pushed around by an actor. And then, you know, bringing in just, you know, where the world was going as far as, you know, LGBTQ rights. So it was really interesting.
Did it feel like anything had changed? Like, you know, the next day, did it feel like, all right, TV is something different now?
We broke through and the world didn't collapse, so we felt good. But we still knew that there was always going to be, you know, a fight about it. And, you know, and you get a lot of homophobia from gay executives that are afraid for their job. So we had a show we wrote on spec, a pilot called Skirt Chasers, about a straight dad who's a womanizer just like his daughter is, and they both can't keep relationships. And everyone loved that and said, we've never seen that kind of relationship. But we have our lesbian show for the season. Like, okay, you can have, you know, 12, you know, NCISs, but you can only have one lesbian on TV. Mm-hmm. So we ended up making it for Tello Films, which is the only lesbian content website, with Barry Bostwick and Elizabeth Keener and Meredith Baxter. And I directed half the episodes, and Amanda Burst from Married with Children directed the others. So I'm just like one that, like, if you say no, I'm like, okay, how do we figure out a way to do this anyway? I don't give up easily.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, in that respect, at least I can see how that would be an asset in, you know, putting a gay kiss on television in what would that have been, like 94, 95?
Yeah. Somewhere around there.
Did you try to put more queer content into the scripts that you were writing? You know, I know you mentioned Skirt Chasers, but were there other attempts to make it gay?
You mean to make our TV shows gay?
Yeah, yeah. To introduce like gay storylines.
I think we just had a gay sensibility. We did. We ended up doing one show where we had a drag contest in it. There was nothing gay about the show. It was just, we had a drag contest. It was somebody was actually hiding out, which was taking it from Some Like It Hot, the movie. I like the idea that we didn't say anything. It wasn't a gay thing. It was just that's what it was. Or even like when we made the Brady Bunch movies and we were reading actresses for the role of the guidance counselor, people like Jennifer Lewis. And we were thinking a diverse actor, you know. So we're reading a lot of Black actors. And then I happened to be having a martini at Revolver in West Hollywood. And this new video came on. It was called Supermodel. And I don't know if it was the vodka or just my like antennas went up. And I was like, wait a minute. What if this person, RuPaul, played Miss Cummings, the guidance counselor? So the next day I went to the director, Betty Thomas, and my writing partner, Jim, and I said, this is going to be the craziest idea, but I think you need to find this video and maybe audition this person. And the rest is history.
What was your involvement with the Brady Bunch movies? I know that was a live show in LA before they became movies. Is that right?
I went to the live show. It was packed. It was sold out. We ended up, Jim and I went and we sat on the floor. It was just this thing that just took over. And I should probably look at my program. I feel like Jane Lynch was Carol Brady in it. Mm-hmm. So we'd seen that, and then we had sold one spec feature film, which actually still want to make it. It's called The Ruthie Ruddock Story. And Jim and I went to one of the first gay and lesbian film festivals, which is now called Outfest in LA. And we saw a documentary called Before Stonewall. And in the documentary, they had said during the summer of 1969, three movements kind of collided at the same time, the Black movement, the women's movement, and the gay movement. And we're walking back to our car and we said, oh my God, it's so interesting that one summer, what if we put some character in the middle of it? And I remember the story of my mother asking my father if she could go to Ann Arbor to visit her sister. And I thought, why do you have to ask your husband that? It's your sister, just go. So we created a movie about a suburban housewife in 69 who goes to Greenwich Village to save her sister from becoming a hippie and gets involved in all the movements.
That sounds incredible.
We thought our agents would kill us. Like, why are you wasting your time, right? You know, like the next risky business or something. Mm-hmm. And there was a bidding war. And all these studios and producers wanted it. We also, because my love for Lily Tomlin, we sent it by messenger to her backstage where she was doing her show in Hollywood. Like a month later, our agent calls and says, why is Lily Tomlin calling us? And she got involved. And so then I got to know her as an adult and work on that movie. The movie's at Universal. The script is One Day We'll Make It. I've even talked with Lily about now playing the mother and having someone like Kristen Wiig or Melissa McCarthy play Ruthie Ruddock. Because obviously we still need to talk about all those subjects, you know, I think in a funny commercial comedy.
That sounds like my eyes are literally glittering right now with.
Well, I didn't even tell you half of it. So this is pre Forrest Gump. This woman accidentally creates all the trends of the time. She was so nervous. She was fidgeting with her white handkerchief on the train. Uh-huh. She spilled her high C in her thermos on it. And she opens it up and it's tie dye. Uh-huh. She was freezing cold and she had nothing to burn. She ends up being out homeless. So she takes her bra off and throws it in the fire. And Gloria Steinem sees it and she goes, yes, we must burn our bras. And in the very climax of the movie, she starts by accident the Stonewall riots. Mm-hmm. So it's things like that that we had fun with about. So one day, hopefully.
Boy, it's just the most exciting time, like in history, like all these things colliding. Yeah. And what a dream to like be able to, you know, put that in front of people like Lily Tomlin. Like, how did that connection happen?
Well, it's through she read the script and then suddenly Jim and I were having dinner with her. And I told Jim, you cannot leave the table. Neither of us could because we were afraid to be alone with her. She was so smart and she was lovely, but to mm-hmm. us, we were super young and intimidated. And she said something like, so what is the epiphany of Ruthie? And I didn't know what the word epiphany meant at the time. So we just, you know, and we didn't have phones where you could Google it under the table. So somehow we talked our way through it and she never knew we didn't know what epiphany meant. But then we got really friendly with her and hang out through the years. And, you know, but I still, you know, kind of giggle to myself when I email her and she emails me back, you know, same day, like, oh my God, Lily Tomlin knows who I am. Yeah. So it's pretty funny, but not surprising when I think of as a kid, I just kind of knew that I would be hanging out with Lily Tomlin. Mm.
Well, it sounds like, you know, you've always had the sensibility that matches the kind of work that she does. Like you're just like in the same sort of comedy sphere.
Yes. But I mean, she's genius. So that she likes something we wrote, I was just like, I cannot fucking believe it. And that movie changed us. And suddenly we, you know, were offered a lot of different movies to write, which led to the Brady Bunch. And then that success, you know, led to us being offered literally every TV show, Bewitched and, you know, My Favorite Martian. And we did a live action Jetson script that we actually did. I wanted to do Bewitched so bad because I love that show. Mm. But we were offered Love Boats and Fantasy Islands and everything.
Wow. What was it like? Was there like a dream project? You mentioned Bewitched.
Well, I love Bewitched and I wanted to switch. I don't know if you're that familiar with Bewitched, but they switched Darren's in the middle of the show.
Yeah, of course.
Remember that? So I wanted to go from Dermot Mulroney to Dylan McDermott and not say anything.
Oh my God. How funny. That's brilliant.
It's nothing. It's just in the middle of it. Just new actor. Boom. But things like that, I would love to. And we're able to do that in the Brady Bunch, which is why that's probably one of the most favorite jobs I had. It was playing with pop culture and being silly and pushing the line as far as, you know, that we had Noreen and Marsha Brady in bed together and did all of that. I mean, and then Greg and Marsha together in the second movie. That was really fun. And I think Bewitched still needs a version of that. You know, it was such a campy mm-hmm. TV show and the casting was so brilliant and the colors and everything. And you know, just having Paul Lynn as Uncle Arthur. I mean, you don't get gayer than that.
You know, it's true. I'm excited for the Billy Eichner, Paul Lynn biopic.
Yeah, I tried to make a documentary about him years ago with my friend Alan Poole, who produced Newsroom and Six Feet Under. And Poland's family would not give us the rights to it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this was a billion years ago. Because there's, you know, some stories about, I don't know how much you know about him, but he was with some young guy in a hotel in San Francisco and the guy fell out the window. Yeah, we don't know the full story.
Yeah, there's, I've seen interviews with him where he seems to be choosing his words very carefully. And, you know, it's, like you say, hard to know exactly what happened.
Yeah.
What was the, so you got offered all this stuff, like where, you know, where did you go? Like what happened in the wake of the Brady Bunch movie?
Well, we got very close with the director, Betty Thomas. And so she would have us do a bunch of rewrites. We would develop some post office heist comedy that Ellen DeGeneres was going to star in. The most exciting one, which you'll probably fall off your chair, was a remake of Valley of the Dolls.
Oh,
yeah. I knew you would. Okay, pick yourself up. And this is also in the book. So I named it Valley of the Dolls, The Relapse. And Betty's concept, which I thought was so brilliant, was that they were shooting a modern day shot-by-shot remake of Valley of the Dolls movie, and all the actors in the movie slowly became the characters in the movie, which was very complex. And she had us rewriting and rewriting, I mean, like for years. And we'd be there, and she started reading actors. And she had, and it was my suggestion to have Beyonce for the Sharon Tate role. And she had Britney Spears come in. She had Brittany Murphy come in for the Patty Duke part. I mean, every actor, young actor in town came in to read for that movie. But Fox never got what Betty was trying to do. And unfortunately, never got to make the movie.
I imagine that is maybe a challenge of the sort of pop culture literacy that is required for it. Like it's such a, you know, lightning striking kind of situation that that Brady Bunch, like people understood. People are like, oh, I get it. Because so
well,
often,
she told us when we're writing it, rewriting it. There had been other scripts, but you know, we didn't come up with the concept of the Brady's staying in the past but living in today's world. But what we did bring in was mining all the craziness from the series. Like Mike's long talks, you know, even silly things like Carol pouring the sugar, and she was so sugary sweet that she kept pouring it, you know, so crazy stuff like that. But Betty said, when you write it, think in three ways. Think for a little kid that have never seen the show, think of people that grew up on the show and love it, and then write it for stoners. And like, we got you on all three counts. And I think that's why, you know, a lot of the movies didn't click, because they didn't think of all those different kinds of people. And so you had little kids coming to it not getting any of the sexual jokes, and the parents were like, oh my god, I can't believe, you know, when like Gene Smart goes, oh, a Brady sandwich, like little kids don't know what that means. And every gay guy's going like, yeah, I'd want to be in the middle of that.
Right. There's there's a quality to this where I guess it's there's sort of a reverence for the original material, but there's also an irreverence, because how can you not?
Nothing is too precious.
Right.
I mean, that, you know, I mean, Alice talks about Sam's meat. I mean, things like that that go over the head of kids. And then other people are stoned out of their mind. Just like, I remember we went to one of the first screenings and they were literally sitting in the aisle. They were sold out and just laughing their heads off, and also smelled like pot in there. But so it was like, we're home.
You know, I've had a lot of very pretentious academic type conversations about, like, is that Brady Bunch movie camp? Does it like, you know, because obviously, you know what you're doing when you write, you know, a movie. Like, to hear you describe like your process here, like, you know, that you're kind of making.
We knew what we were doing. It wasn't something like Showgirls, which to me is one of my favorite movies of all time. You know, I don't think they didn't plan to make it that way. I mean, I don't think like when, you know, Elizabeth Berkley was eating that food and she like, do you direct her, eat it like you're insane and every bite, like chew it like you're crazy. I don't think he gave her those notes. I think they were a little bit, you know, out there. So it was so intense. To me, that movie is like every scene gets crazier and crazier. I've never seen a movie build like that. And, you know, when she's having sex in the water and her head is, I mean, it's insane. And I love every minute of it.
You know, I did a interview with Patrick Bristow, who's the
I directed him and Mindy Sterling in A Tuna Christmas. I love Patrick.
Yeah, no, he's fantastic. And, you know, obviously he's the dance teacher or the choreographer or something. He's like the adjunct to the
somebody
to
that screams at the dancers. Yeah,
right, right. And he has a story about how Paul Verhoeven was directing him, and he kept like shouting thrust it," but because of his accent, it sounded like trust it," and Patrick says that at the time he was like, "All right, I'll just trust it."
Yes, that's so funny. And that oh my god, that I got to direct Patrick after being a obsessed fan of Showgirls was, but I had him and Mindy Sterling from Austin Powers in a play, and so I don't know if you know the Tuna plays, but it's always done with two men, and they play like 12 characters each in this little town of Tuna, Texas.
Is this? I've never heard of this.
It's called The Greater Tuna, is this play, and it was written by these two actors in Texas, and but it's only been primarily done with all men. So you never know, they're coming out as men, women, you don't know. And in my mind, I was like, wouldn't it be fun to cast a man and a woman? So you really didn't know, are they two men, are they two women? And Mindy Sterling as a man just cracked me up with her little mustache and cowboy hat. And Patrick in drag was just like, you know, enough said. And we were very popular for one whole Christmas in LA. I would love to get them again on stage, because I've worked with Mindy Sterling a lot. I got her her first Emmy nomination for another web series I did called Sex and Execs, which was based on 2.5 hours that we wrote for a Lifetime about secretaries and their bosses. And it was like Rashomon. So it was the same time period, but taken from different points of view. So the assistants were the stars in their half hour, and the bosses were in the background, and then it was reversed for the others. So we had a great cast, Olivia Dapo from Wonder Years, and Sandra Bernhardt was in it as well.
That's amazing. It's really like upstairs, downstairs.
Yeah, I still would love to do it somehow again. You know, we shot it for very little money, but we somehow got an Emmy nomination, and I got to direct all of them, and I still think it's would be interesting to do that, you know, with some network money behind it.
Have you had other like just pinch me kind of moments like in your career, like stuff that you're like, I can't believe I got to do this?
Oh my god. Well, right now I'm in the writing the chapters of all the pitch meetings we had with these women that all wanted to be the next Lucy. But they all said that. So one day Jim and I were out having lunch and we get a call. Diana Ross is thinking of doing a sitcom. Would you want to talk to her about it? And we could not have driven there fast enough. I'm surprised we weren't pulled over. I was like, she's never going to do a show, but I want to fucking sit down with Diana Ross. Uh-huh. And there we were sitting in her living room and just talking. I just like, how did this happen? So it's things like that. Or when we were doing research for the Ruthie Ruddock story, they had us go meet Tom Hayden. And because he was an activist at the time in the Chicago Seven, and he was married to Jane Fonda. So we were like at Jane Fonda's house with Tom Hayden, you know, just all crazy stuff like that. That's like, you can't believe, you know, people idolized and suddenly you're just like sitting there, you know, and we had a meeting with Jane Fonda. She wanted us to write a movie after 9 to 5. She wanted to do the same thing that she did for secretaries for airline stewardesses is what they were called. And I couldn't think, because the whole time I'm staring at her beautiful eyes, they're so like blue. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I heard a word she said. Mm.
Yeah, I'm still trying to catch my breath from the idea of Diana Ross being the next Lucille Ball.
Yes, can you imagine? And then I ended up sitting on a plane next to Tracy Ellis Ross. And I told her that story. I was like, I always loved Tracy Ellis Ross. I'm just so happy that she found like such big success. Mm. She's just very talented.
Wow.
I would love to get Diana Ross. This play I wrote about my mother and my housekeeper, in a dream would have Lily Tomlin and Diana Ross doing it on Broadway.
Oh my God. what a pairing.
What a pairing. Well, they're both from Detroit. Mm-hmm. And that's my second play being published. It's called Yes, Virginia. I did it with Mindy Sterling. And both of them have never done a play. Lily has done her one woman shows, but neither of them acted in like a scripted play on Broadway or anywhere really. So get your tickets now.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I could not sign up fast enough for something like that. That sounds amazing.
You have to dream, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's the weird thing is some of these dreams actually do come true.
Well, you know, that brings me back to something I was just thinking about where you mentioned we started talking about
Over the Rainbow. Yes.
So Wizard of Oz. Yeah. That.
Yeah. She dreamed of going over the rainbow and she got to go. And yeah. So that's kind of been my motto is I would just always be in my bed dreaming and dreaming of living in a house in the hills. And I'm in the house in the hills now and getting to work with people I love and respect and, you know, seeing, you know, doing little theater now a lot and seeing the level of actors that now are responding or wanting to be in do plays with me has been so thrilling.
Yeah. So tell me about like the work that you do now. I know you mentioned teaching a lot, but what are you working on and what can people like, see from, do you have like theater stuff happening right now or is there stuff?
Nobody does, but I'm hoping to come back with my latest play called Have a Good One. And it takes place in 1999 at an Abercrombie & Finch type store. So it's four characters and two of them are those shirtless, beautiful male models. So that may sell a few tickets. Sure. But the theme of it is heavy, serious in that, I don't know about you, but when I look at like pictures of myself when I was younger and I was going, you were hot. Like I felt so ugly at the time. And it got me thinking, what is beauty? Who decides what is beautiful? And why can we not appreciate how we look at the moment we're in it? And so the play deals with that because, you know, like Abercrombie had such a type that they consider beautiful. And we deal with time and within the piece of looking back on that period and where we are now and talking about it. So it's a very, very funny play, but it has other messages in it. So we're hoping to do it in September and October in LA somewhere, but I'm writing a musical with my writing partner called Long Beach Blanket Bingo. It's an interracial love story kind of between the time of Hairspray and Hair. And it's about a young teen black girl surfer, which there were back in the day, and a white boy and segregation on the beaches. And we noticed it when we were watching those old Annette Funicello, Frankie Avalon movies. And we noticed there were no black people in the movies. So that got us thinking, well, black people doing during that time period. And that led to the story. And then I got the rights to use the catalog from my very good friend, Allie Willis, who unfortunately passed away in December of 2019. And she wrote the Friends theme song, Boogie Wonderland, September by Earth, Wind & Fire, The Color Purple. And so all last summer, we were going through her songs that she wrote with, you know, Maurice White and James Brown and Jimmy Cliff and Cyndi Lauper. And I mean, it was just insane. And so we are keeping her legacy alive and introducing all these really cool songs that never got recorded.
Wow. Oh yeah. My gosh. That sounds great.
That's intense. Yeah. And I also want to give kids another musical to do in high schools. And obviously after last summer, I think it's important to be able to talk about racism in a pop culture way. So it's not, you know, just in classrooms, it's everywhere that we need to talk about it. We need to have these messy conversations. Although some people don't think there is any racism. So there you go.
Right. Sure. Well,
sure.
Our work is done.
Yeah.
Wow. This is fantastic. So if folks want to connect with you online,
So Zimmerman Stan, I'm on Instagram and Facebook and I have a webpage and hopefully you'll be in your area doing one of my plays. I'm going to be going to the Gilmore Fan Festival in Kent, Connecticut in October. I'm doing my Suicide Note play in Detroit in October 21st. And then the Golden Girls Fan Cruise, which is January 3rd through 8th, 2022, out of Fort Lauderdale. We had so much fun in early 2020 on two back-to-back cruises of packed with Golden Girl fans. It's called Golden Fans at Sea. And it's just the time of your life. And I've met so many friends that are now part of my family.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Yay. It's so great to connect. Like, you know, there's this sort of, I don't know what to call it, but like a collective, I guess, of folks who just like speak the language of that, of pop culture and comedy. And it's nice to see, you know, just folks coming together over that.
Well, thank you for talking about it and having this forum to do it in.
Glad to do it. Stan, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Again, that sounds dirty.
Thanks to Stan for joining me, and thanks to you for listening. And thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get backer rewards, including a fun care pack in the mail. Check my YouTube for deep dives into queer pop culture history at youtube.com/mattbaum and my newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin McLeod of comptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.